in a November sale is opportunity. Really excited about the changes we've made to the Horses of Racing Age portion of the sale. The timing of the Horses of Racing Age section is really well suited to the industry.
It allows us to build for the future, and the future is bright.
The future is bright at Gamewon November.
Good morning. It is 11:20, Sunday, November 7th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. I'm so glad we had daylight savings last night, so I had an extra hour to stew over that nonsense in the juvenile turf.
I am Bill Finley, correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News, and I might be the only one in the world who didn't bet Modern Games. You know what, like everybody says they were there for Willie Mays' catch? It's that kind of thing, you know, okay.
Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable, and I was so pleased that one of the horses that won the Breeders' Cup race was actually named after one of the co-hosts here. So congratulations to Bobby Flay for naming Pizza Finley, winner of the juvenile, no? Pizza?
Oh, so that was my only good bet of the weekend. So you're not going to take that from me.
Pizza Joe Bianca. Congratulations, Joe. You nailed that one, actually. Actually, all kidding aside, you know what? Our picks were really, really good. The three of us actually had a lot of winners.
A lot of chalk, though.
Well, like we said, more chalk than, you know, blah, blah, fill in the blank. But yeah, but we definitely hit a lot of them.
Pizza Finley.
Did you guys get your Lane's End glasses?
No.
Oh, you didn't get your Honor AP Lane's End glass yet?
Where's the swag?
Wow. Yeah, I got the Honor AP Lane's End. I got the Darley vest.
Wow.
And the best race of the week.
Who sent you all this stuff?
Well, life is good. I've had this shirt. When I turned 50, they gave me this shirt.
Oh, okay. But I will change right now out of this shirt.
But whatever you change into, make sure you have a second one for tomorrow.
trying to help the brand over there.
and the brand appreciates it. Pizza, yep. Bianca.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. Take part in the Keeneland November experience from November 10th to November 19th. So that starts this week. You can learn more at november.keeneland.com. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we are super thrilled to welcome to the program from USADA, the CEO, Travis Tiger, and the director of the equine program, Dr. Tessa Muir. Thank you so much for coming on with us.
Yeah, it's awesome. Really, really glad to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much. Really excited to be talking to you today.
Yeah, absolutely. We're so flattered that you guys have come to us to kind of release these new rules. So basically, let's start with a broad question here. Why are you guys here? What is the overarching news here that you guys are making with these releases?
Yeah, well, thanks for having us. It's great to be back. Wonderful to see you three again. I think it was a few months ago. I went back and looked at it. I think I had a full beard at the time. So we're making our way, now that we're vaccinated out of the COVID crisis. So we appreciate, the chance to be back. And it's wonderful to see you all. Listen, as I said then, we're honored to have been asked to play a role. We're here now because the rules that we've been working on with the authority under the new legislation are being released for public comment for the first time on Thursday. And we're, honored to play a role. I've described it, this process, as like the triple crown for the industry to really change and return the sport of horse racing to where it once was. And, the eyes of the globe can be on it, not just, the eyes of the FBI, frankly. And that's a wonderful thing for all of those who love horse racing. The first leg of that triple crown, is, as you all know, and we talked a little bit about it last time, was getting the legislation passed. And there were, bold leaders within the industry. Of course, some people there that were opposed to it, who were fearful of change or, had success in the mediocre program now or just wanted the status quo to remain for various reasons. And look, they're probably still going to be opposed to it as the legislation now is enacted and the program is starting to be rolled out. But that was the first leg. And you got to give a lot of credit to, the Jockey Club, to WOA, to the Stronach Group, to Churchill Downs, the Breeders' Cup. I mean, the list goes on of the folks within the industry that stepped up to get the legislation passed. I think the second leg of the effort and the Triple Crown is the rules themselves. And that's why, you know, Thursday is such a big day, and that the rules through a pretty long process up to now are being published for public comment. And what I can tell you is we're really excited and frankly, really satisfied that the rules are headed in the direction of putting in place a gold standard program for the industry here in the United States, which is awesome. The third leg of it is the implementation of those rules. And, you know, we still hope to be involved with that. If the rules end up in a position that we can stand by, you know, we hope to be there with the authority, but that's still to come. But that's really the main purpose of us being here today, and want to, you know, make sure people appreciate what those rules are and the significance to the industry of those rules.
We're gonna get into all the specifics, but I just wanted to ask a question, a follow-up question, mainly to Tessa, since you have experience in the racing industry at the BHA and in Australian racing. Who have you guys consulted with within the U.S. racing industry along the way to come up with these rules and this process?
Yeah, well, we've consulted with a lot of people. Obviously, there's industry experts on the Anti-Doping Medication Control Committee. Last week, I was at the Breeders' Cup, so getting an opportunity to speak to a number of vets from all different areas of America. And, you know, I've obviously known people within the industry here in the US during my time at the BHA in Australia. So we've certainly spoken to a lot of people and got their feedback, and hope to continue to get that as we move forward too.
Yeah, and really important, I mean, process-wise. And I think we've provided a timeline for you all. And, you know, if you show it on the screen, you can see, I mean, a lot of, hard work has happened and a lot of progress from our standpoint. This happened from the authority, right? The law just got enacted in January. The authority was selected in May. The staff, the CEO, was hired in June. We met with them for the first time in July. And to now, you know, just a couple of months later, have gone through an elaborate process. There were 27 industry groups that were provided the rules. They gave feedback on the rules. Tessa mentioned the committee that has industry people directly on it, experts within medication control laboratories, and from a state racing commission standpoint, the authority itself has, you know, four industry designated experts on it out of the nine people total. And there's been a lot of revisions to the rules during that process to get it to this stage. So we feel like there's been, you know, ample and plenty of industry feedback. Of course, we're still looking forward to the next two rounds, because as you'll see on the timeline, you know, publication to the public today on Thursday for feedback, you know, we'll consider that along with the committee and ultimately the authority. It's their decision what goes to the FTC. But then the FTC has another public comment period. You know, it's way more bureaucratic, frankly, than we like and that what we're used to. In our world with human sport, you know, it's usually the sport decision makers get in room and decide along with the athletes what is best process. But we're happy with this process and satisfied that it'll get us where we need to be and heading in a direction where, you know, we would be willing to stand by the program. And let's just hope, you know, it's not diluted or in any way gutted significantly or material changes in the final rules that, you know, we're certainly not going to stand by a program that we can't stand by, but we don't think that's going to happen. We think it's headed in absolutely in the right direction.
This might be a question for Tessa if she wants to jump in, or Travis. So rather than you saying rule one is this and rule two is this and rule 475 is this, what are some of the major changes that racing will see under these new rules vis-a-vis what the rules are now?
Yeah, let me just jump in, and then I'll let Tessa chime in as well on some of the more specific issues if you want. But I would say, and, you know, I've testified in Congress numerous times about what goes into an effective anti-doping program, sort of the elements of an effective program from a rule standpoint. And I think, you know, again, these rules incorporate those elements to it. And they're pretty straightforward. One, it's, you know, a uniform and harmonized national program. And particularly in this sport, it's incredibly important because right now there's a myriad of different rules from state to state. And what happens in one state is different than another state, creates confusion, and people don't trust a system that creates confusion. Two, it's independently implemented. And these rules call for an independent enforcement agency. Now, that may be USADA, that's us, or it may be a different agency. That's sort of the third leg of who ultimately is going to independently implement them. But that independence is absolutely important from a fairness and a consistency standpoint. Now, number three, well-defined violations. So I think we talked last time, you guys asked me, hey, can you bring a case if you don't have a positive test? Well, in some states today, I don't think that's even possible. Under these rules, yeah, you look at Article 2 of the rules, and it identifies about 12 different types of violations. Only one or two of those includes a positive test. So possession, trafficking, complicity, attempted administration, retaliation against a whistleblower. Those are things that can be an anti-doping rule violation or medication control violation that would result in a sanction, which leads me to the next element, which is effective sanctions. And I think you'll see a graphic that we've put together, but is embedded in the rules, basically Article 9 and Article 10 of the rules, where it's a certain period of time that we think are an effective deterrent. They're fair in situations where someone is not with an intent to cheat and may not have the same level of fault. And so we've made adjustments for that. And then I think you have to have a fair process. And you look at, again, there's an infographic, I think, that would show the results management process, but you see due process being afforded to anyone that's been accused of a violation, can go through various levels of that legal process to have not USADA making the determination. We'll be there to present the evidence and to seek justice for the rule violation, but it will be independent people, stewards for, you know, secondary minor violations and out of a national steward panel, and then arbitrators for the more major consequences in any situation where aggravating circumstances may be argued. And then there's an appeal or review process by an administrative law judge, and then ultimately the FTC. The last point I'll say is transparency. And we've always prided ourselves here at USADA on being open and transparent, because we firmly believe that's the only way you can convince those that you're asking to follow these rules to support what you're doing. And so who's tested and what's tested for after the fact, not before, because you can't compromise and let people know they're going to be tested, but that can be posted. Notice, as you see in the results management infographic that was provided, notice will go to the authority, State Racing Commission, if they want it, the owner and the trainer, if someone has been accused of a violation, whether positive test or otherwise. And then even the hearing process by the arbitrator in major cases can be open to the public if the arbitrator decides with certain restrictions put on it. But that's how you gain the trust of those who are subject to these rules, is those elements being included. And we're thrilled that they are included in these rules. Obviously, education and then funds for research to continue to advance the science are fundamental elements. They're included where they can be in the rules, but those are more of a program arena. Sorry, anything you want to chime in on?
I think Travis probably hit the nail on the head there. The key one for me is that uniformity and harmonization and the independence that we bring. I also think that when people look at the protocol, in a lot of ways, things are maybe presented slightly differently to what they're used to. But there's a lot of similarities when you look into that and you look at the prohibited list to the current ARCI model rules, as far as the sort of the principles and things behind that. Something that people, may jump out to people is the concept of whereabouts. And with the out of competition testing, knowing where horses are is absolutely critical to being able to test those horses at any time. Now, we totally appreciate that that's, a burden that I think is light compared to the risk of being cheated out of, purse money because a horse is getting beaten by someone who's cheating. But that is a burden, and we completely appreciate that and realize that with the whereabouts, there's going to be a need to have good technology solutions that make it as simple as possible for people to be able to administer. And also that's going to need to be a sort of a transition and a phase in, and that's not going to be one of those day one things that's 1st of July next year. You've got to file whereabouts for every horse in your care. And I think we've, you know, said before, and I think it's really important, this isn't going to be day one, everything absolutely rolled out gung-ho. 18 to 24 months for us to sort of build this program and sort of reach that gold standard point where we can all stand and be really proud of what we at USADA, what the industry has done to secure horse racing's future in the US.
That's great. So guys, I own horses. So walk me through the process of one of my horses that gets entered into a race at Gulfstream. We'll just use that as an example. And the horse is coming in from Palmetto's training facility. Okay. So it's not an actual racetrack, but it's a training facility that's accredited and that horses, you know, can come in and breeze on that racetrack. They get approved and they can come in and race there. So my horse, you know, Bing Bong comes in from Palmetto's and goes into the, you know, one of the barns in the back of Gulfstream. What goes on as far as the testing, the pre-race testing, the post-race testing? You know, can you give our audience an idea of like what would happen from step one to step two to step three?
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess the first point of that is once your horse Bing Bong becomes a covered horse, he or she may be subject to out of competition testing, even if he's at the training or she's at the training facility. Once you then ship into the racetrack, again, if it's before race day, then, you know, again, you may be subject to out of competition testing there. If it's on the race day, similar to what you probably experience now with your horses, there is a potential for pre-race testing. One of the key things in pre-race testing is the TCO2 testing, so the blood samples that get collected. Your horse obviously then runs and may be subject to testing post-race if it's called for testing. And so it will get urine or blood, maybe hair taken at any of those points. So it would be fairly similar in that sense to what you probably experience now, with the exception of potentially an increase in the out-of-competition testing.
And would you say that if a horse was coming in from a training facility, that would be more likely to be pulled and have more additional testing, or is it just completely randomized from, you know, from the get-go?
It's not random. I mean, we don't use, yeah, it's funny, in our Olympic program, and athletes used to ask this all the time. Well, you know, is it like the lotto that I see pulled every Wednesday night? Where right. They ball out and they keep pulling them out, and that's who you test until all the balls are out and you dump them back in. Not like that at all. It's very what we call intelligent testing, not random. Some call it smart testing, some call it target testing, but we use data. You know, it's interesting, the point, you know, the comment you just made. We've heard from a lot of people in the industry that, oh, the horses never leave the track or the training facility. And if they do, that's indication that, you know, they're out doing something that they shouldn't be doing. So those are for sure things that if you're in our shoes, you monitor and look at the whereabouts. You know, in the cycling case, Lance Armstrong case, for example, all the cyclists on U.S. Postal lived in Girona, Spain during the peak training season because Spain didn't have an effective anti-doping system. And it was really tough for us to go into Girona, Spain and test. So these are things that are not any different in horse racing than they are in human sports, and our programs are designed in order to, you know, prevent those, and certainly not you, of course, right? But prevent those who may be attempting to, you know, hide their horse to dope them up, so they, when they then show up, gain an advantage and cheat bettors and other competitors on race day.
You know, you talk.
You know, I don't know if you want to finish. You know, the sample taken would then be shipped to an independent, not under our control, a laboratory, but that laboratory would have to follow the new standards that the authority ultimately put out. And then that laboratory would analyze those samples, and then those results would be handed back to us. And then we would provide, you know, notice of the negative test result to you so that you would know. And then if someone else had a positive test result, it would flow through that results management process, and the rules that are outlined would apply to those individual cases.
Travis, you talk a lot about investigation being a big leg of this. It's not just an anti-doping testing. You know, it's not just about testing and banned medications, about investigations, about intelligence. So can you take us down that road and talk to us about how the investigation and intelligence arm of this might work? You know, whether or not you guys have the authority to help increase security at some of these racetracks. There was a story that Bill did recently a couple months ago about the jockey club using speed figures to track potential cheaters, trainers that are moving horses up a bunch off of other trainers. Can you give us some of the facets that you're going to use to help increase security, increase intelligence, increase investigation?
Yeah. And Joe, thanks for the question. I mean, it gets a little bit to the program side of it, not necessarily the rules side of it, but really importantly, the rules allow for, you know, evidence that can be gathered legally to be used in the process to hold people accountable. And I think that's really important in having a good set of rules that, you know, you can legally use evidence that you properly obtain. And that evidence, I mean, and again, the rules, I mentioned the protection for whistleblowers, that you can't intimidate, harass, or retaliate against someone that comes forward. You know, it takes a community to protect the environment. And so now there's protections for people to be able to come forward and pick up the phone. And look, I can tell you, we don't even have jurisdiction yet, but we're already getting calls from people who are pointing us in directions and providing evidence that we're having to, you know, sort through, and that could be valuable evidence. I think I mentioned last time when I was here on your show, we had in our human program close to 500 tips that came to our Play Clean line. We've now rolled out a text version of that we just announced a few months ago that will be incorporated. If we're running this thoroughbred horse racing program, will be incorporated into that program as well. So all of that is critically important. Having the right type of people and properly trained former law enforcement, federal and state, to vet those tips and that information, and then properly follow up on that information, whether it's target tests based on it, whether it's, you know, following up directly with racetrack security, or, you know, having cameras or other types of opportunities to obtain evidence, asking people to sit down and be interviewed. And there is obligations under the rules for covered persons to cooperate with that kind of investigation. And the authority has subpoena power. So the, you know, obtaining documents or other records could be part of it. Obviously, looking through veterinarian records that the authority has under the act has access to can also aid in that part of the process. But really putting a close eye on the evidence that is generated to ensure that, you know, people aren't using just the fact of a negative test. Or you guys saw in the Navarro indictments, I mean, they were talking about how the stuff they were using wasn't detectable by the labs. And that's what the cheaters do. I mean, we see that in our world all the time. And so you have to have other means, what we call, again, a non-analytical positive. So not necessarily using a traditional positive test, may not have any scientific evidence. Typically, there will be some scientific evidence, but coupled with, you know, those traditional buckets of evidence that you see on Law and Order and, you know, NCIS every time those shows run. And that's what, you know, we've built our program around here at the United States Anti-Doping Agency on our human and Olympic or our UFC and our Olympic Paralympic program. And really don't see it any differently for our equine program if we get to that stage.
Travis, you just touched on this, but I want to bring us back to drug testing. And we all know that there are hundreds, maybe even thousands of medications that people can use and they will not get caught because there's no testing for it or no means to catch them by the drug test. Will you guys, to put it very simply, do a better job catching these drugs than the current system?
Listen, I think the inconsistencies in the current 11 labs, some are doing and trying to do a really good job. Some don't have the funding to do a really good job. But it's clear there's going to have to be good, robust, scientifically sound standards that all samples are analyzed by. And what's also clear is some labs aren't doing a good job and they're not being paid at any reasonable level to be able to do a good job. So that's going to be an issue. The other point along that same line of thought, the rules do account for the opportunity for what's known as an athlete biological passport or equine biological passport. So you just mentioned, you know, hundreds of substances that are out there. Some labs may not be testing for them currently. Maybe there's not a scientifically valid test for those substances. But what we have built into the rules, and it's not there yet, but we're also pushing the equine science and research to eventually get there. And other parts of the world are doing some of this research on an equine passport, where you can look at the biological markers of an equine athlete through the samples that you collect over time. So you're not looking specifically for the direct drug, but you're looking for the impact of any drug on the horse's metabolism and their bodily functions and parameters. And that in our human world has become a game changer to a large extent. If you remember, Lance Armstrong in his Oprah Winfrey television interview said the introduction of that program in cycling is what caused him to stop doping. I think he went other ways to try to defeat it and got caught, but it was a significant game changer in the world of cycling when it was introduced at the time. And we're hopeful, again, science has to get there, but we're hopeful that with the concerted pooled resources and a determination to get the science there in a real way to have real impact, that hopefully we can get there.
Yeah, and I think the Kentucky laboratory are doing a lot of good work on the biological passports. One other thing that I think we probably haven't mentioned yet is also the ability to do retrospective testing, so putting samples into storage. And then when you develop new tests in the future, being able to bring those samples out of storage and actually then analyze them with the new methodology for those prohibited or timed substances, so the ones that should never be there, to look for those retrospectively. You know, that's also a great deterrent to people using things where they say, well, you can't detect it. But in the future, when those technologies and the capabilities are, you know, enhanced and changed, well, then we can go back and you will still be subject to sanction under the rules that were in place.
I have a question for Tessa. You know, one of the big things that happened in the last year that I think kind of even brought this issue to light even more was the Bob Baffert, Medina Spirit positive drug test for betamethasone at the Kentucky Derby. You know, I think outside of racing, people thought, oh, well, that's a juiced up horse on steroids. That's why he won the Derby. I think people within racing know that 21 picograms over the level is not why Medina Spirit won the Derby, but that's what gets all the headlines. Meanwhile, like you guys are saying, some of the drugs that actually are harming horses and actually are changing the results of races can't be tested for. Can you speak to maybe some trainer out there who's using legal therapeutic medications that's maybe concerned that they're going to, you know, test a slight amount above the legal threshold and then get lumped in with some of the people who are actually really trying to skirt the rules?
Yeah, and obviously not specifically talking in respect to that case, but concentration of a drug in a sample doesn't necessarily relate to the effect that it has on the horse. So that's just a sort of a general principle. And I think when we're looking at those, and one thing that when we got some feedback on the rules we looked at was the difference between a doping violation and a medication control violation. And I think that's a, you know, something that we really worked on, getting some of that initial industry feedback on the rules. Of course, you can also misuse or abuse those therapeutic medications. So they can be escalated through aggravating circumstances to a doping violation. But one of the things that we've worked hard at is to look at that to sort of give a bit more clarity around those potential mistakes that might happen with the therapeutic medications versus the deliberate attempt to gain an unfair advantage over your competitors by using either doping drugs or misusing and abusing therapeutic medications. And I think the one other thing that's really important is, although there is a bit of a distinction there, we've got to remember that those therapeutic medications also have that potential risk to the health and welfare of the horse. So the potential for those catastrophic breakdowns and also to the long, you know, detrimental to the long-term soundness of the horse. So whilst it's important to be able to treat horses responsibly, they're athletes, you know, they need to be cared for. We've got to remember that we've also got to ensure that we're doing the right thing by the horse for both its current, you know, health, and also for its long-term soundness, because it spent, the horses spend some of their time in racing. They spend a lot of their time after racing in other careers. So that's really important too.
And just to, you know, to put a further point on it, the rules, again, that are out, take that in consideration and define certain things as medical control violations versus anti-doping violations. So we're totally sensitive to that issue and appreciate it. In addition, the sanctions that flow from those types of violations based on the substance and the nature of the violation can be entirely different. One may be 2 years for an intentional cheating situation, or possibly aggravated to 4 years for a prohibited all times. It's an intentional cheating situation versus, you know, a public warning or a reprimand or a fine if it's truly a genuine mistake. Now, multiple genuine mistakes get treated more severely, as they obviously should be. And you know, while I think this industry blurs this issue way more than other industries, we're sensitive to it. And it's not something that we're unaccustomed to dealing with, because you can look at our Nike Oregon Project case, where a coach and a doctor were suspended for 4 years. In large part, the culture they created was using, you know, otherwise acceptable medications for health in ways to, you know, dope or, you know, misuse and abuse those medications to get their athletes to the starting line. And what we know is, you know, racing, whether human racing or horse racing, is not an ailment that justifies misuse or abuse of even a legitimate medical therapeutic to get someone to the starting line. And so we get it. We deal with it in our human world as well. And I think most importantly, the rules that are being presented today sufficiently and absolutely account for that in a fair way.
And Travis, you mentioned before about how some of the labs are underfunded, and that's why they're not up to snuff. The $100 million question, how is this program going to get funded? What's the mechanism? Is it going to be a tax? Is it going to be a per race per diem that owners are going to have to pay? Because I think, Tessa, you mentioned before, you know, it's, we can all kind of give a little bit in as long as we know that it's a level playing field. We don't mind, you know, paying a little bit to know that it's a fair race all the time. Who's going to pay for this?
Yeah, it's an authority question, really. But the legislation says is the authority has the ability to, you know, go to the states through the state racing commissions or directly to those who participate and compete in those states. So, what I would say from a cost standpoint is that the industry really can't afford not to put in good rules and implement a good program. You know, I think the large majority, 85% of the costs will be laboratory costs and the collection costs, which can be currently, in control of the laboratories at this point. Obviously, they've got to meet the new standards, and we'll see what the costs are when those new standards are put in place for the lab analysis. The collection costs on race day, you know, ideally, we're relying on state racing commissions, but, you know, some of those costs could be, you know, reduced. We're hopeful of. There's other areas that we think there will be some economies of scale, like, you know, for example, having, you know, a lawyer in every racing district who prosecutes a positive test. You know, if you can consolidate that in one program, like we intend to do if we're involved with the program, I think you can, you know, shrinking those costs because you have the trained expertise in order to do it. But I also look at the numbers in the industry, right? And I mean, the numbers I've seen, horse racing industry overall, $4.9+ billion business. We saw the Breeders' Cup this past weekend put an announcement out that they had $182 million up 5%. In large part, you know, they had the largest number of foreign horses and the market over in Asia, I think Hong Kong in particular, you know, got behind, or maybe Japan got behind betting because of the horses that were there, in large part because of the medication rules they put in place. I got to think the drugs that owners aren't going to have to be paying for now. You know, we've heard the term from industry insiders, veterinarians have turned into needle jockeys, and they're giving horses drugs because that's the culture that exists. And maybe they're legitimate therapeutics and maybe they can justify racing as an ailment to get them to the start line. But my hope is overall, there's some savings in the overall, you know, industry when it comes time to putting in a program. That said, I think the industry has to put in a good program because we know the legislation passed in large part because of the existential threat that was out there to the industry. And it can't afford not to put in, I don't think, a good program that really restores it to the prominence that it once had. And particularly, you know, if I'm an industry leader, and I'm not, but I look at, you know, the betting situation in other sports. And if I were, you know, someone involved with the betting money, I would be pretty nervous that now, you know, you can bet from your couch on the NFL, Major League Baseball, all these other sports that are open, that are transparent, that have good rules in place. You know what you're betting on. Here, it's a different scenario. And so the offering becomes a lot less attractive when it had the monopoly like it did just a few years ago. So I think the time is now. Obviously, Congress agrees, and let's hope this can get done in a real way to provide the kind of meaningful change that I think has to happen in order to restore this sport to where it once was, and frankly should be, because it's an awesome sport.
Travis, in a response to an earlier question, you distinguished between quote unquote dopers and people using therapeutic medications with overages. But you also said something to the effect that if you have too many overages with therapeutic medications, that might be a red flag as well. I hope I summed up what you said accurately there. So what about the Bob Baffert situation? Can you give us an overview of it? And how might have things been handled if USADA had been there on day one when Baffert started running into all these problems?
Yeah. And let me, you know, we're not involved with the specifics of the case. Obviously, I, you know what I know from following the news on it, but taking it out of that context, but let me give you some principles from the rules that may, you know, be applicable in any case that comes up like that. One, there's the opportunity to provisionally suspend someone. Okay. And that means they're not allowed to compete or have horses compete in other races until the violation that they have is finished. Now, it's optional on secondary type offenses. So something like an overage on a butte, it would be optional, but it's still a possibility. If it is put in place, importantly, the person who is provisionally suspended would have the opportunity to go to a provisional suspension hearing and have an independent arbitrator decide if there's probable cause to keep that person from competing. Also, the rules have the ability to expedite a case. And so, you know, I was pretty stunned to hear that the Kentucky case this weekend hasn't been resolved yet. That's not going to happen on our watch. I mean, that's crazy that it's taken that long to get to a final resolution, particularly when someone's competing the entire time. And it's no different, again, in our human world. I mean, we have an athlete test positive. We had one of our early cases in 2002, the Jovanovic case, a bobsledder. We got the initial case, the appeal done within 10 days of the Olympic Games, because there's no way we're going to allow an Olympian representing the United States show up at the Olympic Games and compete with a pending positive case. Just not going to happen. So then your question kind of asks about the multiple violations. So, you know, the rules are very specific. You know, if you have a minor violation, a secondary substance, right, like a butte, a legitimate medication that you have an overage on, first of all, the risk of the overage is on the person who provides the drug. And it should be documented well on records that are obtained to support that it's truly an innocent mistake. And the legal process in quick fashion will get to the bottom of that. But if there are multiple minor offenses, secondary substances, you know, those add up. And at four, that then becomes a major violation, which is punishable up to 2 years. So, you know, this idea that you can rack up minor violation after minor violation, which seems, again, not specifically talking about any particular trainer, but is a comment we've heard throughout on the way those state rules work is just not going to happen under these rules, and nor should it continue to happen, in our opinion.
So Travis, does that mean that everyone comes in with a clean slate once you guys come aboard, and doesn't matter what past history people have?
Yeah, that is according to the act itself, is that anything that's happened, whether final violation, final adjudication, a result, or something that's pending or a violation that hasn't even been brought yet, will not be factored in to our effort moving forward. It still stays within the state's jurisdiction. And you see how various states are dealing with some of those types of issues, whether certain tracks are going to allow them to compete or not. That unfortunately can still happen on anything prior to the effective date of this program.
I think it's important though to add there that there's a lot of this information that's publicly available. And where we talked earlier about, target testing or risk-based testing, we can still use that publicly available information from people's previous records to sort of direct how we conduct our testing and sort of how we target and direct tests. So it can't be used in reference to the sanctions and the results management, but it can be used to inform our test distribution plan and our program going forward.
Okay, good.
Wait, just to follow up on that, how about the tips? You said that people are giving you tips, but you don't have jurisdiction yet. Does that all go out the window once the act goes into effect, or no?
Well, if no new violations, I think the legal term is, I'm going back in the cobwebs. I think the legal term is ex post facto. You can't be held accountable for something that wasn't, against the rules, a crime or against the rules when new rules come into effect. So, while the evidence we certainly can look at and review and use, if new violations of our rules, once they're in effect, don't happen when they're in effect, then we wouldn't be able to use it. But certainly, any evidence that leads us to, discover evidence of a violation when the rules are in effect would be, allowed to be moved forward on.
All right, so great stuff so far. We appreciate Travis and Tessa being very, very generous with their time. And we'll be right back after a couple of messages from our sponsors. The TDN Writers Room was brought to you by Keeneland. The Keeneland September Yearling Sale produced 6 winners during the Breeders' Cup. Knicks Go, Aloha West, Life is Good, Golden Pal, Corniche, and Echo Zulu. A couple champions in there as well. Keeneland sales grads also swept the top 3 spots in the juvenile fillies with Darley Alcibiades winner Juju's Map and Tarabi following Echo Zulu home. And the Keeneland November sale starts Wednesday, as I said. The book just became available for the Horses of Racing Age section, which is on Friday the 19th. So it starts this Wednesday, November 10th. John, what's your plan?
I'm actually leaving Joe on Tuesday to head down to Lexington. I'm planning on looking at a lot of mares in book one, some mares in book two, and then also see if I can get a sneak peek on some of these Horses of Racing Age that's going to be the following week down at the Keeneland sale. But I couldn't be more excited, not only because I haven't been to Kentucky in 2 years, but what better destination site than Keeneland when you're traveling down to Kentucky?
Absolutely. And as Keeneland sales grads continue to produce on the track, we'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
The November sale is a destination event for buyers and sellers around the world.
The ambiance during the September sale was incredible.
As we move into Keeneland November, I think people will find a new experience, a new atmosphere, new optimism. Anybody who participates, buying and selling, when they participate in Keeneland, they're reinvesting in the industry. That is the mission. It allows us to build for the future, and the future is bright.
The future is bright at Keeneland November.
Spitestown. Munnings. Echo Town.
It's Echo Town for Joe Talamo, and Echo Town raced away.
And Echo Town is drawing away in the stretch. Echo Town wins the Allen Turkin Stakes.
A sire line so prolific, it repeats itself. Echo Town.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Congrats to Coolmore with Golden Pal in the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint. I think one of the most impressive winners of the weekend got a 107 buyer. He's popped out to the front. Never looked like a loser in that race. He's the fifth horse in Breeders' Cup history to win two different Breeders' Cup races, back-to-back years, too. They talked after the race about bringing him back as a four-year-old, saying in the Royal Ascot, so that's very exciting. He was also the 10th grade one winner for Ashford superstar sire Uncle Mo. Unfortunately, Jack Christopher on Friday had to scratch, but he's a horse that we're definitely looking forward to seeing in 2022. Sky is the limit for him. And also Air Force Blue making some news over the weekend. King of Dreams was another stakes winner for him in the Showing Up Stakes, and it was the second stakes winner in 24 hours for him after Astronomer won the Golden Mile Stakes at Del Mar. So Air Force Blue coming on as well. All right, so we're back with Travis and Tessa. Just a couple more questions. I have a question about sanctions, and I think we tend to focus a lot on the sanctions of trainers because they're the absolute insurer, they're the responsible person in this scenario. But I think there are other people that facilitate cheating in racing, namely owners and vets. You know, one of the problems that we have in racing is there are certain owners, I won't name any names as much as I would like to, that when one of their trainers gets busted for drugs, they just jump onto another trainer who is very obviously cheating, and then we'll jump to another trainer. I know less about how complicit the vets are. I'm sure Tessa would know more than me about that. But what do you guys have anything in the rules that would also deal with the owners and the vets as well as the trainers?
Yeah, I think, I mean, the first thing there is that when the horse is in training, the trainer is going to be the ultimate insurer, you know, strictly liable for a positive test. But obviously out of competition, if the horse is going back to the owner could also be potentially the responsible person. When the horse is in training, the owner, the veterinarian, anyone else involved with the horse, they can be held accountable if they're complicit and part of a doping or a medication issue. The strict liability of the positive test doesn't apply to them. So a slightly different way that is prosecuted, but they absolutely can be held accountable under these rules.
Yeah. Basically, the responsible person is held strictly liable for a positive test, where other people, owners, vets who treat the horse, if they knew or reasonably should have known of the possible violation, the administration of the drug in violation of the rules, then they can also be held accountable at the same level. So we think that's a really important aspect to avoid exactly what you talked about. And most importantly, it's not just the trainer training the horse that has responsibility for this culture of clean sport. It's everybody within the sport should have a responsibility to ensure that it's being done the right way.
And guys, one of the things that you mentioned before is that hopefully these new rules will come into effect July 1st, which seems daunting, quite frankly. It's like 200 days away if you really, narrow it down. And then on top of that, you have a couple of racing jurisdictions that are actually against this, against the new rules and have actually implemented lawsuits. Is that going to affect the start date of July 1st?
So I think, obviously we talked earlier a little bit about those who have been fighting and obstructing uniformity in this industry going back before the legislation was passed. So it's unfortunate that they filed the lawsuits that they did, in our opinion, and it's obviously going to, has delayed things and is exhausting precious and limited resources unnecessarily. We're still running down the track to have these rules out in the way that they need to be out, education in advance, and then implemented, by the program effective date. Unless the FTC says something differently, that would ultimately be our hope. Now, obviously, the reliance on the state racing commissions now, who, the July date is in the middle of the racing season and middle of state budget. So hopefully they're going to continue to do the good work in the places where good work is happening. Through the end of the season, where we can, have more time to fully ramp up the elements that need to be rolled out immediately. And I think, as Tessa said earlier, we don't expect, whether it's whereabouts or other parts of the program that we think, meet the gold standard, those are 18 to 24 months from that July 1 effective date before they're fully implemented and having some chance to take effect.
Travis, speaking of racing commissions, I would imagine that not all of them are your best friends. Once you guys come in, they're going to have less power, less authority. You might even cost a few people their jobs because there'll be less responsibilities for a racing commission. Knowing that you need their cooperation and need it very badly to get all this working, you know, what kind of feedback have you gotten, and do you see any of this being a problem?
So part of obviously discussions we've been having recently and with the authority as well is having calls with the state racing commissions. They've obviously got a lot of questions for us. Some of them we still can't answer. We're still working through a lot of those things. But I think it's really important to have those dialogues and to sort of be aware and cognizant of the potential challenges. And some of them are sort of challenges in all of the states, and some of the challenges will be state specific. So we're working through those. And I think we're really hopeful that we will, looking to the future and looking to the sport being successful, work together and collaborate with as many of the current infrastructures as possible within those state racing commissions. You know, some of them are doing a really great job, and we want to continue to, work with those people and the things that are working well. Of course, there may be, as you say, people who don't agree with it. And if that's the case, then we will have to also obviously work with that and, work out how we do things in those particular states as well. So yeah, there's a lot of further discussions to have. People to, talk to, those communication channels need to stay open so that we can address the challenges as they come up. And, getting these rules and getting feedback from people now is important. And then, looking at the implementation, how we roll these rules out and how we get to July 1, but then from July 1, how we get on, that 18, 24 month period after that.
And your question reminded me how my wonderful wife and three great kids always remind me how impatient I am at every moment. Like we were ready for this January 1, 2021. And it's been hard not to be where we want to be to roll this out. But we're going to continue to work through. There's obviously, big challenges. Part is related to the state racing commissions and relying on them, through next season in large part to do the race day testing that they're currently doing and working closely with them to make sure that this program is implemented as soon as it possibly can and in a really effective way. And I'm hopeful, while, it's easy to say, they're not, looking forward to this process. I would hope, and we have heard from many of them, their frustrations, when their state, they feel like is doing a really good job. And they see, other states not doing a great job. It tears down the integrity of the whole sport. And so we're hopeful that, all ships are going to rise with the tides. And, those that otherwise have wanted to do a good job and have fought hard to do a good job, finally, there's this legislation that allows, all that good work to go into effect in a real and robust way, finally.
Guys, I just have one more question for you both. You put together the draft and all the different timetables and schedules and rules and regulations, and I'm sure it was just a daunting task. What was individually your favorite sections of the rules, and what was the most difficult where you were like, I can't get my head around this. This industry is so backwards. I don't know what to do. So what was your favorite part, and what was the most difficult part?
So let me say first, I think what you said about, the robustness and the daunting, I think was the term you used. It can be, particularly if you're not, familiar with the rulemaking process. But I don't think that needs to affect how you see this program, because I think it really boils down, if you're, in the sport, a trainer, owner, vet, it really boils down to three simple points to be successful in this program. Number one is, don't do drugs or give drugs to your equine athlete. Number two, if your equine athlete, your horse really needs a genuine, legitimate medication, just check the list or pick up the phone. If we're running the program, call us, and we'll have also an online option for that if we're running the program. And then number three, when the whereabouts program is out, just simply provide the location of your horse and have them available for testing out of competition when we come to test them. So I really do think it is that simple to live successfully under this program. You know, the most frustrating, and then we'll go, the most frustrating to me was just this blurred line between what we talked about earlier, the medication control, which in some cases is the abuse or the misuse of drugs, and the industry not seeing that as doping and wanting to kind of water down and justify. You know, I mentioned the term we heard from industry insiders about vets who have turned into needle jockeys and some that don't want to go into the practice because they don't like the level of drugs that are being given to horses that seems to be commonplace. So that's probably a frustrating view, but it's a view that, you know, we fully appreciate and are hopefully going to separate out and cause to be better moving forward.
Yeah, that was good. I think for me, it can be a challenge because we've got to remember that this is a bit of a transformational change. So securing the future for the sport, making sure we've still got that social license to operate. And it's really important to go back to that. What's been my favorite thing about it is probably, I think it's a huge privilege to be involved in this process and be involved in, you know, making US racing, you know, forefront and back on the, you know, the national level of people loving it. And I think something that I see every day when I walk into the office here, the quote of success is not final, failure is not fatal. It's the courage to continue. And that thing, you know, we've had obviously some really tough hours and some really hard decisions that we're sort of having to grapple with on some days. I mean, you know, that's just the nature of rulemaking. But really, it's keeping that sort of that eye on the end goal, the vision of what is it we're all here for. We're here for the horse. We're here to keep the horse safe. We're here to make the sport fair for those trainers and owners and people who invest in the sport and love it, and the bettors and the public who come to the races and embrace our sport and come and see these amazing, amazing athletes racing. And for me, it's not a specific part of the rules themselves. It's the principle behind what it is we're doing with the rules and what it is we're doing and what that stands for the sport.
Tessa, I could not have said it any better than that. That's a perfect way to wrap up. Travis Tiger, Dr. Tessa Muir, thank you guys so much for coming on. Thank you for the time and keep fighting the good fight. We appreciate you guys.
Thanks so much.
Thank you all. Appreciate it.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guests of the Week, Travis Tiger and Tessa Muir will receive free one-hour tax consultations. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. I mean, I went on and on last week about what a great resource XBTV is for the Breeders' Cup, but really it's a great resource year round. You know, if you're attacking the Saratoga meet or the Del Mar meet, you know, you want to see some unraced 2-year-olds work out and get a better sense, you know, of who to watch out for. And, you know, coming up to any big race, really, you can go check out the main contenders, Breezing, and, you know, just, you know, there's a little bit of nuance in workouts that I think you learn when you look through the XBTV database. that you might not necessarily know just looking at the line of workouts on the paper. So I think that that's a great service to horse players, and you should definitely go to the XBTV website and check it out. Sign up for a free first account so you can start watching works and improve your handicapping. And this week's XBTV workout of the week is Flightline. We talk about Flightline a lot with West Point. We're so excited to see him in the Malibu later this year. He worked 3 furlongs and 37 and 4 on Halloween last weekend. So check out the Flightline work, as I'm sure it's playing right now as I'm talking in your face. And, you know, there's probably a lot of Flightline works to come. He's going to have a long run up to that Malibu race, and we're excited to see every single one of them. So he's a super exciting horse, and XBTV brings you to the morning workouts better than any other possible resource you could come up with in racing. Okay, so we're just going to do a little reaction piece here to the Breeders' Cup races. We're not going to go through all 14 races like we did in the preview show, because we're going to take it easy on the listeners and the viewers. We were amazed at how many people actually watched that show because of how long it was. But the main two races we'll start with are the Classic and Distaff. We all said before the weekend that those were the two marquee races in terms of deciding championships. We'll have a couple other thoughts maybe throughout the 2 days, but we're not going to go through everything. The Classic, honestly, to me, left a pretty sour taste in my mouth. And it was mainly because of the way they just let Nyx go. You know, if you watch the way Medina Spirit was run, John Velasquez had a hold of him. And I saw some conspiracy theories. You know, even a guy on TVG was saying that, you know, there was like a gentleman's agreement between Johnny and Joel. I don't really believe that, but it was a little bit obnoxious, I thought, the way that race was run, because it was over a quarter mile into the race. We wanted to see this big battle and to have the closers have a chance and for it to be a really real deciding classic. And really, it was over a quarter mile into the race. Nyx Go was never going to lose once he got loose like that through a 23 and change quarter going down a straightaway. And listen, he's had a great year. He's going to be a deserving horse of the year. He's going to be a deserving champion, older male. But we wanted to see a little bit more of a clash, I think, early and late, and to have him actually have to eyeball somebody. That was the main thing, is he's just such a different horse when someone actually looks him in the eye and forces him to dig down. And I honestly wanted to see that. And so that was very disappointing. And it seemed like kind of maybe an overreaction to the Distaff, because the Distaff was such a suicidal pace that I don't know, like, whether they were, you know, Johnny was riding for second or whatever. He did get second with Medina Spirit, so if that was the case, then it worked out. But, you know, in the Distaff, they really just cooked each other. You hardly ever see 21 and 44 for a 9-furlong race. And that race obviously completely fell apart late. It was cool to see the Japanese horse get the photo. That was a very exciting finish. And that was another subplot of the Breeders' Cup, with Japan not getting not just one, but two Breeders' Cup winners, you know, getting the first one and then the second one an hour or two later. So that was my takeaway, is that, you know, Nyx Go, take nothing away from him, deserving horse of the year. He ran a bunch of big races, but I wanted to see more of a battle in the Classic. What do you guys think?
Yeah, Joe, it's funny. I was driving in Saturday morning in New York City. I was listening to an interview with John Velasquez, and it was about how, he's going to go with Medina Spirit. He knew all along what a good horse this was, but he wasn't really able to show it until they got aggressive with him early. He's not going to take back. You're right. This race was over three jumps out of the gate. And I said on the preview show, I said that John Velasquez will decide this race, because Art Collector and Hot Rod Charlie have speed, but they weren't the ones that were going to go after Nyx Go. If it was going to be anybody, it was Medina Spirit. And you're right. When he didn't go after him, when Medina Spirit got a length and a half in front and 23 in the first quarter, there's still a mile to go in the race. The race was absolutely over. So it was very anticlimactic. But in fairness to Velasquez, you know, what if he had gone with Nyx Go and they went 22 flat for the first quarter? Then after it's over, everybody says, well, what was he doing? He got into a suicidal speed duel. Here it was, the Distaff all over again. So he was kind of caught between a rock and a hard place. And, you know, I don't know if he did the right thing or not. He got second. It was a very, you know, a dull race. It really didn't have any excitement to it or anything like that. Another thing that was interesting is, I guess the bettors were thinking all along the lines that there is going to be some sort of pace battle here and it's going to cost Nyx Go. How did he pay 3-1, 840 in there, when essentially he looked like the, you know, obvious favorite in there, and Essential Quality went off at the 9-5 favorite. So, yeah, but, you know, Nyx Go, take nothing away from him. This is a very good horse. He's had a tremendous year. He won Horse of the Year, showed up when it mattered. And, you know, congratulations to the Connections.
Something that was really surprising to me, and that was, you know, that Essential Quality was the favorite. You know, when I was making my picks, I thought I was being cute by going, you know, counter to the, you know, Knicks Go, because I thought, well, he's going to be 6-5. So let me go ahead with, you know, with the 3-year-old and see if I can, you know, sneak in there and win. So when he was, you know, when Essential Quality was going off as the favorite, I was scratching my head as well. It seemed like there were a lot of people that were jumping off the Knicks Go bandwagon, and I understand why. I mean, I was looking for reasons to beat him as well in the race. But hats off, you know, he went to the front. He forced the issue. Joe, we talk all the time about jockeys that need to force the issue. When you have the best horse in the race, you get him out in front or you keep him clear. And that's what happened. What I think it does, though, is it opens up at least a conversation for us and other pundits to talk about who's going to be 3-year-old champion, because there's a lot of talk on social media right now about, hey, Medina Spirit beat Essential Quality, and therefore, you know, he should be considered 3-year-old champion. There's a lot of talk that, hey, Essential Quality did everything that he needed to do and just came up a little short in two races. One was the Derby and one was the one was, you know, the Breeders' Cup Classic. And, you know, he should therefore be 3-year-old of the year. I would make a case and an argument that Life is Good should be 3-year-old, you know, champ based on what he did. Again, I think visually, that was the most impressive Breeders' Cup race out of the 14 in my eyes, was Life is Good winning the race that he did. And I really feel like that he should be, you know, in great consideration for 3-year-old champion, even though he had less of a resume as far as less number of races. He was explosive in just about every single one of his races, including the Breeders' Cup, the big ass mile. And Bill, by the way, just for giggles, I went ahead and because I was bored yesterday in between races, and I put the big ass fan into Google Translate, and I translated it into Greek, and I translated it into Japanese, and I translated it back into English, and it came back as the Sizable Donkey Club. So next year we'll have to make shirts for the Sizable Donkey Club mile.
This is the stuff that only John can bring to this show, and it's because he needs another hobby in his life. So just to touch on the 3-year-old horse of the 3-year-old champion discussion, to me that's insane. I don't know why people were talking about this. Essential Quality won the Belmont, right, and the Travers. Medina Spirit won the Derby and then tested positive for above the threshold for a legal substance. And the difference in the Classic was 3/4 of a length, and Medina Spirit had that easy trip just stalking the base, and Essential Quality was way back. He was basically the only horse in the race to make up any ground. So if you're saying that 3/4 of a length should upend the entire year of what Essential Quality has done, Medina Spirit was AWOL for most of the spring and summer after the Derby. Essential Quality won the Jim Dandy. He won the Belmont. He won the Travers. Like, I don't know what more he could have done during the summer while Medina Spirit was licking his wounds, no pun intended, from the Derby. So I think that's a little crazy. And, you know, pound for pound, I do think that there's a case to be made that Life is Good is the best 3-year-old in the country. I just think resume wise, he missed too much time. He didn't win the Allen Jerkins as great as he ran. And he won the Kelso against the total layup field. And then he won on Saturday. So, well, I agree that he is maybe the most impressive 3-year-old in the land. I just think, you know, it's a slam dunk 3-year-old championship for Essential Quality. What do you think, Bill?
John, I don't think it's a slam dunk, but I will vote for him. A couple things first. Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, I do think Life is Good as the best 3-year-old. But John, his, just like Joe said, his body of work wasn't enough. That was his only grade one win of the year. And but the thing that's interesting about Medina Spirit is, what do you do with the Kentucky Derby? Now, I'm with you, Joe. Even if you give Medina Spirit credit for the Kentucky Derby, I think Essential Quality's credentials are better, but it's close. And also remember that they ran against each other twice, and both times Medina Spirit finished in front of Essential Quality. So I think the people that are making a case for Medina Spirit are not totally, you know, coming out of left field with this. But, you know, if a voter likes Medina Spirit, I guess you got to say that the Kentucky Derby counts. And I'm okay with that, because as we speak here on November 7th, or when your vote is going to be cast, closer to the middle of December or whatnot, he's still officially the winner of the Kentucky Derby. And I don't think that's going to change anytime soon.
So I want to get through some of the other takeaways from the weekend. You know, unfortunately, one of the biggest stories of the weekend was what happened in the juvenile turf with the late scratch. So we're going to talk about that, the whole thing with modern games and that controversy after the next break. But just wanted to get through some of the other on-track observations from the weekend. You know, John mentioned life is good. That was honestly the most impressive race of the weekend for me. And it's not as if it was like Nick's Go where everyone decided, you know, once the gate opened or a little bit before that, to grab and let the horse who everybody knows is impossible to beat when he gets on a loose lead, go on a loose lead. This was a race where Life is Good had to out sprint Jasper Prince to the lead. There were other horses who tried to get the front in that race, and he just out sprinted them, cooked along the lead on 21-4, 44 and change, and really just dominated in the stretch. I thought, like John was saying, pound for pound, he might be the best three-year-old in the country. And, supposedly he's coming back next year for the Pegasus and the Saudi Cup, perhaps. So it's going to be interesting to see how much he can stretch out that speed. Hopefully he has like a robust four-year-old campaign. I'm going to hold my breath a little bit on that one because I've seen horses be as great as him and minor thing comes up and they don't see them much again, but hopefully he'll come back and have a good four-year-old campaign because he's a super, super exciting animal. We talked about Golden Pal, obviously a very brilliant turf sprinter. It'll be good to see him as a four-year-old as well. As far as the two-year-old races, honestly, I was not that impressed with either of the dirt winners. I know that might be a little bit of a controversial opinion. Again, I thought they both had a very easy time of it. You know, the problem with having a six-horse field in the juvenile fillies is that once Juju's Map and Hidden Connection didn't get out of the gate, again, the race was over. The race was over. As soon as the only two horses that could beat Echo Zulu didn't get out of the gate, they might as well have just wrapped it up and walked Echo Zulu over to the winner's circle. Like that to me was one of the most disappointing things of the weekend, is how many races were over basically before they even started. And the other one I would mention, the Japanese horses too. Love's Only You was a great, great story. And it was a really exciting finish with getting a late split between horses to get up and give Japan its first Breeders' Cup winner. But the other one I got to mention is poor John's Gamin did not get it done on Saturday. John didn't watch the race, by the way, not to tell tales out of school here, but I texted him condolences and he said, What happened? You weren't even watching Gamin. How dare you?
I thought you were talking about the day before with Coinage. I was like, what happened? And the other reason why I was surprised about it is because you were like, condolences. And I was like, oh, Gamin didn't win. And then I was like, wait a second. The horse that we said, if Gamin gets into speed duel, CC's going to win, did win. So I was like, well, wait a second. So we were kind of half pregnant on that. We were kind of half right.
I mean, I was on Edgeway, and I should have had that exact because Edgeway ran second at 16-1. But yeah, I mean, we said all year that Gamin did not quite seem like the same horse that she was as a 3-year-old. That bore out to be true. You know, she definitely did get pace pressure, but come on, it was a 5-horse field. Like if she was still that same champion that she was last year, she's supposed to beat those horses no matter what. So that was disappointing. And my guess is we won't see too much of her anymore. She still has had a great career. You know, she's nine, no disgrace being 9-11 on the racetrack. But she did seem a little bit vulnerable on paper, and that ended up working out to be the case. Just any other takeaways from the weekend's races, Bill?
Yeah, I think we could say some of the same things about Jackie's Warriors we said about Gamin. I mean, he faced a tougher field than Gamin did, but he really had absolutely no excuse. And I don't remember what everybody said in the previous show, but I think we're all in agreement that this is probably the most likely winner of the entire Breeders' Cup through the 2 days. The pace was fast, but it wasn't so fast that it should have done in a horse that was if he was as good as we thought he would. Now, maybe he just had a bad day. We'll see. And also, by the way, the sprint championship is kind of interesting. As much as we love Jackie's Warriors, he's only won one grade one this year. So, I think he'll probably still get it. But Dr. Shivel or whatever heck you want to call him, is made a case for that as well. And then going back to the Friday races, I mean, we got an ongoing story here that's going to be very interesting. What are the owners going to do with Corniche? Gets no points for winning this race. That's okay, because during his three-year-old year, there's plenty of points out there that he can pick up. But I can't imagine they possibly stick with Baffert unless something happens that Baffert gets this overturned, and it doesn't look like that's going to happen. So, at some point, when do they say, Bob, we got to go someplace else. Do they do it right away with a three-year-old year? Do they do it coming up to the last prep, you know, the big 100 points races? Or do they show unbelievable loyalty to Baffert and say, we're just going to go for the Preakness? I don't think that's going to happen. But that's something that, you know, is really going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
You guys brought up some excellent points. A couple more just to put a bow on this year's Breeders' Cup weekend. First of all, hats off to the Breeders' Cup and to Del Mar for doing just an outstanding job getting everything coordinated, getting everything together. And also, I thought the TV coverage was really good this year. You know, they had a ton of footage and a you know, behind the scenes and jockey cams and paddock cams. And, you know, just it really lent itself to like a real sporting event. You know, which is, I think, the first time in you know, maybe ever that horse racing series actually had, you know, the real coverage, like it was a baseball game or a football game. It was really intriguing to me. No injuries, no horses getting hurt, no jockeys getting hurt, nobody clipping heels. You know, really, we look at you know, just you know, the timeline about 2 years ago, and Bill, I remember we talked about this off air, that California racing was, you know, was on life support. I mean, there was a lot of political, you know, pressure to get rid of racing, horse racing in California. And here, just 2 years later, they had, you know, one of the strongest Breeders' Cup, you know, weekends that we can remember. And they had an almost pristine safety record for their race meets as well, you know, which is outstanding. So, you know, again, hats off to those outfits. You know, we mentioned some of the great races. Life is Good. Love's Only You was just shot out of a cannon midway down the stretch. And that was after running 10 and a half furlongs and still had a kick at the end to go between horses, you know, which was really amazing to me. Echo Zulu remaining undefeated. Golden Pal, I just had a wow next to the race because it was just, the race was over two steps out of the gate. Maryland Breds. How about, you know, we're known for football and crab cakes, but also now for two Breeders' Cup champions, you know, with Nix Go and Aloha West, which I thought was really, really cool. Japan breaking through was excellent. So, again, hats off to them. And actually, speaking of hats, how about the purple fedora? I mean, if you're going to go to a race, you know, wearing a purple fedora, you know, you're loaded for bear. So, again, congratulations to Japan for winning not one, but two Breeders' Cups, getting off the schneid and winning a couple of them. But, you know, Love's Only You, you know, to be able to sport that Prince fedora was really, really stout in my mind. That was impressive.
Let me just add one more thing, because I think we'd be remiss if we didn't say it. Charlie Appleby.
Yeah.
Is this guy unbelievable or what? He won 9 stakes races in the U.S. this year. They were either all grade ones or that race at Belmont that is eventually going to be a grade one. And he only entered in 14 races, 9 wins out of 14. And this might be crazy, but I have some thoughts that maybe he should be trainer of the year.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
Yeah, we're going to say that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like if there was ever a guy who only ran 14 times in America. Exactly. And should get champion trainer votes. He's that guy.
And including 3 Breeders' Cup wins. I mean, it's just unbelievable what this guy did.
And that's with half of his Breeders' Cup entries getting scratched at the gate.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I mean, it's really, you know, he had more horses that were loaded and ready to go. Literally loaded in the gate and ready to go, and didn't make it out of the gate. You know, for the race. But no, Bill, you're right. I mean, as far as since we're picking horses that have short resumes as horse of the year and you know, 3-year-old of the year, it's not unthinkable to offer up, you know, Charlie Appleby, saying, I know he's got a short resume here in the States, but he's got to be in consideration for one of the top 3.
Yeah. Brad Cox is going to win, but I would agree that Charlie Appleby should get some votes, because you want to talk about the impact at the grade one level in America this year. He was right up there with anybody with a very limited number of starters. And that was wild to see him twice get one of those horses scratched at the gate and then watch the other one go on and win. The other thing with the Bob Baffert storyline, you know, I felt like his horses ran about how you would expect. You know, we thought Gamine was a little vulnerable. You want to say that she disappointed. You know, I can agree with you there. Corniche still won. You know, he didn't have that many starters. That was the whole thing, was that you would expect Bob Baffert usually to have more, maybe like a dozen, 15 starters in the Breeders' Cup. He only had a handful. private mission, as you would expect, ran up the track after dueling on that suicidal pace. Overall, I think his horses performed about up to par, which I guess is a feather in his cap with all of the extra scrutiny that he was going through. But yeah, that's going to be an interesting subplot going forward, is to see where Corniche and maybe some of his other top 2 year olds end up, because there's just no way. There's no way anybody is that loyal to Bob Baffert that they have a potential Derby horse and they're going to skip the Derby to run in the Preakness just to keep Bob Baffert in their good graces. It's not going to happen, buddy. So we're going to keep an eye on that going forward as well.
And Joe, the owner even alluded to that when they interviewed him. They were literally standing in the merch holding onto the trophy, and they asked him a question about Baffert, and all he would commit to is Bob's done a great job with this horse, but we'll have to see. I mean, that's telling. I mean, you're on the stage, you're literally receiving the trophy for a horse that won the Breeders' Cup, and you're not willing to say, like, he's my man?
Throw him right under the bus.
Right under the bus. Like, you did a good job. Now I'm going to hand it off to somebody else who can get me to the Derby.
And it's reasonable. Like, he put himself in that position. It's not the owner's fault. Bob Baffert put himself in that position. Sorry. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. And there's plenty of stakes action over the weekend for West Point at the Breeders' Cup. Giant Game ran a big race in the Juvenile to finish third, trained by Dale Romans, son of Giants Causeway. Will be definitely a horse to watch next year. As a three-year-old. And he also had a winner at Churchill Downs over the weekend with Shadow Matter winning an allowance optional claiming spot for Dallas Stewart. Three-year-old Colt is owned in partnership with Pearl Racing. So congratulations to the partners. And a big, big placing in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile with Giant Games. And congratulations to you guys there as well. So we'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
Now more than ever, it's time to get with the program, because New York Breds start with an advantage. New York Breds run for a serious green at Belmont and Saratoga. New York Bred maidens run for up to $75,000 and allowance horses for up to $85,000. And serious New York Bred owners can collect awards of up to $20,000 per horse per race in open company. So get back with the program. Seriously.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the New York Thoroughbred Breeding and Development Fund. We had a big retirement last week in the New York bred world. Mr. Buff, who was a very, very popular New York bred, retired last week after a 17-win career. I love Mr. Buff. Yeah, he retired with two New York bred championships. He won Older Dirt Male in 2019 and 2020. In six seasons on the track, he won 11 stakes and made every start but two in New York. Mr. Buff was a real New York warhorse. Talk about a horse, and he wasn't like one of these horses that, you know, went to Gulfstream or went away for the winter. He would run in all those races during the winter, like the Damon Runyon and all these races that used to be run on the inner track at Aqueduct. That's no longer a thing, but he would run all through the winter and was just such a hard knocking horse and a very, very admirable horse for John Kimmel. Obviously made a bunch of money in those New York bred stakes, and really he could compete in open company too, but they found his niche as like a New York bred speedy dirt router. And, you know, he'll be missed, but he's definitely earned his retirement. So salute to the connections of Mr. Buff, and best of luck to him and his the rest of his life. And also Son of Thunder retired to Waldorf Forms. The son of Uncle Mo was a full brother to Lauban, who was a very good early, first or second crop sire until he unfortunately passed away. But that's a big, like I said, to have those sons of Uncle Mo and these, major, major superstar stallions start to populate the New York breeding program, I think is a big deal to have those families represented in the New York bred program. So it's another son of Uncle Mo. We talked about Galilean before. It was son of Uncle Mo, who is now coming to New York, to stand in New York. So that's a big deal as well. John, do you have any thoughts about the quality of the New York bred program?
Yeah, and Joe, don't forget, don't forget probably one of the most timely, bullet points that are talking points that we should include, which is if you buy a mare at one of the upcoming breeding sales, whether it's, Fasig or Keeneland, you buy a mare for $50,000 or more, regardless of where it's spent, where she spent her time, she can be considered a resident New York mare if you bring her right from the sales grounds up to New York. So it's a huge advantage, especially with all of these better bred stallions that are now popping up in New York. So, if you're going to buy a mare at one of the upcoming sales for $50,000 or more, you can move that mare and in utero foal to New York, pop out a New York bred and start taking advantage of all the benefits of having New York breds.
So we have to talk about this. We have to talk about what happened with the juvenile turf on Friday at Del Mar. And, that's, to me, it doesn't overshadow the weekend because there was too much good racing. And, like John mentioned earlier, I think one of the best stories was that no injuries, no controversy in that way. Even the horses that flipped in the gate were okay. That was the main thing because, you have that many horses running and training and, it definitely is a potential for some kind of terrible story in that way. So we're glad we got through that. And Del Mar has a very good safety record. So, I think they've earned, to be in that rotation for the Breeders' Cup. However, on Friday, this was an absolute disaster. If you didn't watch, or if you were only caught like the cliff notes of what happened in the juvenile turf, they were loading and Charlie Appleby had two horses on the inside post. One, the number one was Modern Games. The two was Albar. Now, both acted up in the gate, but Albar acted up way worse, flipped, and to the point where he was sitting on his butt in the gate. Very, very scary situation where his legs were dangling over the top of the gate for a little bit. Thankfully, he was okay. They backed him out. He jogged back to the barn. Charlie Appleby reported that he just had a couple of, superficial scratches on him, and he's going to be fine. So that's the most important thing. But then Modern Games was backed out of the gate and scratched by the vet until about 5 minutes later, they decided, actually, he's fine. Let's let him run. Let me just read you the sequence of events. And this is from the CHRB advisory. So I got to give them at least a little bit of credit for releasing this and having a little bit of transparency. I'll just read this to you. Okay. The CHRB determined that, as discussed in the aftermath of the race, Modern Games was scratched by the stewards on the recommendation of one of the track veterinarians, Dr. Chuck Jenkins, at the starting gate at 5:35 and 35 seconds Pacific time. After additional examination and assessment of Modern Games by the attending veterinary team, track veterinarian Dr. Dana Stead concluded that the horse had not been injured and communicated to the stewards that the horse was cleared to run. This is the key part right here. Due to a miscommunication between the stewards and the Del Mar Mutuals department, Modern Games was reinserted into the Paramutual wagering pools at 5:37:01 Pacific time. At 5:43:49 Pacific time, after it was made clear to the Mutuals department that Modern Games was competing for purse money only, the horse was again removed from the wagering pools. The race went off 4 minutes later. And of course, Modern Games won the race. So if you're a bettor and you had Modern Games, and there were a lot of people because he was a short price, if you had a pick four closing to him or a pick three closing to him, at least if you had a win bet or an intra race bet, you get money back. If you had a horizontal wager, your wager went to the post time favorite who did not win the race. So you essentially got your money taken from you. And it was the problem to me. There's a lot of problems with this. First of all, the terrible communication, the ridiculous clown car that is racing in terms of communication between the stewards and the track management and the mutuals department. It was just complete nonsense. But the main thing to me is if the horse can be scratched by the veterinarian and then reinserted into the race, and then the horse can be reinserted into the pools, why is the horse then going to run for purse money only? That was the determination. They had to run for purse money only because the horse was scratched initially. You've seen this sometimes before. Usually it's early scratches. They'll report early scratches. There'll be a mistake and they'll say the horse has to run for purse money only because he can't be reinserted in the pools. This horse was reinserted into the pool. So it wasn't a technology thing. It wasn't as if they could not put the horse back into the pools. They just decided to have the horse run for purse money only because that's the law of the land. And it just makes no sense. And it just continues a pattern of thinking of the bettors last after everybody. The people who actually fund the game and who the game would not exist without them are thought of absolutely last in terms of connections, in terms of the track. They don't care. Like, it just, people are fed up of feeling like stepped on and disrespected as people who fund the game. And you know, I got a lot more to say about this, but I've been going on for a little bit. But Bill, you must have some thoughts about this.
Yeah, no? I mean, yeah, there's not a whole much more to add. And you know, you touched on the major problem here is the gamblers in here. And the worst part of it was, yeah, at least if you bet on the horse to win, you got your money back. But, you know, people that had him in the pick five, pick four, et cetera, not only did they not get their money back, imagine this, you bet a winner and you lose your money. I mean, huh? That's actually what happened here. I think the conclusion was that, you know, there was just too many people involved in the process. You know, this vet looking at this horse and this vet's going to scratch him and this other vet's not going to. I think the Breeders' Cup learned a lesson. And they said afterwards that I forget which of the vet, maybe the second one, the guy who said he was OK, was going to be the only one that could determine who would determine whether or not a horse was to be scratched before the race. But yeah, I mean, you know, what chaos, embarrassment, you know, clown car, you know, and normally the Breeders' Cup is a very well-run event. I'm surprised that they screwed this up so badly. And, you know, we need people to love this game. We need people to have fun with it. We need people to think they've got to, if you're a gambler, you know, you're going to lose your money, but at least you want to think that you got a fighting chance. And this happens to you. You're just like, well, you know, why am I bothering with this?
And this reminded me of a baseball game, and Bill, you'll appreciate this analogy, where, you know, they pinch hit for a defensive shortstop and they tie the game up. And then the guy who pinch hit for the defensive shortstop has to go out and play shortstop. And of course, and you know, basically can't field a grounder. And of course, the ball finds that guy. This was the weak spot, obviously, in the entire, you know, rules and regulatory situation for the racing. They handled all the safety issues. They handled all of the veterinary issues, and which, again, kudos to them for doing all those things. But when it came down to this, it was a cluster. I mean, it was a complete cluster, not only for the bettors. I mean, and first and foremost, you know, you feel bad for them. I don't know what system would work. You know, people have discussed, you know, have complained about, well, my horse scratched, so I get the wagering favorite. I don't know what else they want them to do as far as, you know, pick a horse for them, or they're not going to give them more time to reassess the race and you know, give them another 15 minutes to make decisions. But be that as it may, you know, the system is the way it's set up. The problem also, aside from the bettors, you know, have a legitimate complaint, is that, ironically enough, this was the worst race that could happen to. It was the last race with a bunch of 2-year-old colts, you know, running in the race. They had 12 of the 14 horses loaded in the gate. We actually were number 13 and were just about in the gate when all of this happened. So they had to back everybody else out. Well, then it took another 10 to 15 minutes, depending on which clock you're using, you know, before the horses could get back in the gate and then start again. And again, as an owner of a horse in the race, that wasn't the reason why we lost. OK, did it help our cause? No, we have a hot blooded Tappet colt and he was starting to get hot and sweat. And his mental focus was like out the window as soon as they had him halfway into the stall at the gate and backed him out. But there were a lot of other horses that it affected also in the race that ran kind of substandard. And again, were we going to win the race? Probably not. But it didn't help. What it did do is it did help the very cool, calm, and collected Modern Games, who basically, you know, got kicked and still was able to run a very impressive race after all of that. So I think that they're finding the stress test of this situation. And I'm hoping that whether it's California Racing and or the Breeders' Cup are going to change the rule to make it more streamlined. But I think this stress test, they obviously failed. And if nothing else, hopefully it'll beget better results going forward.
And, you know, like Bill said, I think there are too many cooks in the kitchen in these kind of scenarios. And it just, you get the impression that they're just making this stuff up as they go along. And that is not what major sports do. And I tweeted at this at the time, but like, do any other sports routinely embarrass and befuddle and leave their fans and their customers dumbfounded like this on the biggest stages. Like, I think back to 2 years ago, the Kentucky Derby with the 22-minute disqualification of maximum security and then answering no questions about it, reading a 30-second statement. Like, how many clowns have to be exposed in racing before we actually get it together and treat the betting public for what they are, which is the engine of the sport? We still do not do that as a sport. And it's, you know, like John said, you know, with all the safety stuff going on, that's the hard part. That theoretically should be the hard part, trying to keep all the horses and all the riders safe and the things you have to cross your fingers for. This should be the easy part, to not screw over the bettors in such a ridiculous way that anybody who has any concept whatsoever of parimutuel wagering can say, what are you guys doing? This is a ridiculous clown show. To me, I mean, you know, in terms of fixes, you have to streamline this stuff. The one vet was like, scratch him. And then a couple of minutes later, the other vet was like, actually, he's good. And then they reinserted the horse into the pools and then took him out again. That to me is the worst part. It's not as if they scratched the horse initially and they were like, well, there's nothing we can do now. The horse has been scratched. They put the horse back into the pools and then scratched him again. Like, why? Why? What is the purpose of something like that? That is just going to enrage your customers so much. You can talk about the rules and about how it had to be, you know, they got the purse money only rule. That's a fix that I think we need to make. Get rid of the rule. Get rid of that purse money only rule, because it just leaves such a bad taste in people's mouths. And it happens in racing all the time in New York, where they have entries and one part of an entry scratches and then the other part runs for purse money only. Why? Why does that have to be the case? I get the idea that, you know, if you liked one half of the entry and that's the half that scratches, you're stuck with the other. Like, that happens a couple times a year. Too bad. It seems to happen more often that the other part of the entry wins and you get absolutely nothing for it. And the only time where it makes sense, honestly, to do something like that is if, say, the horse threw a shoe in the paddock and the trainer's like, oh, I'm going to run him anyway. Then it makes sense to protect the bettor and be like, well, this is an impediment to this horse. The trainer's deciding to run him anyway. The bettor did not have they had no opportunity to, you know, analyze that information when they made the bet. Then you run for purse money only. All this other arcane, ridiculous nonsense, running for purse money only just because the horse was, you know, mistakenly scratched, needs to go, because this cannot happen on the rate on any stage, but especially on racing's biggest stage. This absolutely cannot happen. And people have a right to be outraged at the Breeders' Cup and at Del Mar this weekend, because, you know, from an otherwise, you know, pretty much impeccable racing production, this was a major, major black eye, and we're tired of it. People who bet on this game are tired of being slapped in the face and treated like they don't matter when they should matter more than anybody else. The owners got to run their horse. Godolphin got to cash that check. Charlie Appleby got a second chance of running. He got to cash that check. The bettors who were alive to modern games got kicked in the nuts, and they have to walk out the door and be expected to come back and bet the next day. It's unacceptable.
They actually paid to get kicked in the nuts.
Exactly.
It's basically what happened. That's pretty much the takeaway from all this. And Joe, you said, I just want to reiterate one thing, and that is whenever I've seen races where a horse runs for purse money only, it is specifically to protect the bettors. That's exactly why they have the rule. And you mentioned, you know, a horse that bends a shoe on the way or in the paddock, you know, getting saddled, and they have to pull the shoe off. So a horse is running with three shoes. Well, that's exactly why the rule is there, to protect the bettors from that standpoint. But this was and I think the other part of the equation as to why it was so, you know, muddied was that instead of backing out modern games like they did with all the other horses, they opened the front of the gate. So the horse actually galloped out for a couple of strides, you know, out of the front of the gate. And I think that led, I can't, you know, speak for the first vet, but I think that led the first vet to be like, well, it's an automatic scratch at this point in my mind, or I'm leaning towards an automatic scratch because the horse went out the front of the gate and therefore probably had to, you know, spend some energy. And on top of it got kicked, I'm going to go ahead and scratch the horse. The second vet made the right decision, in my opinion, because the horse won. So obviously the horse was sound and doing okay. But the key of all this is you got to protect your fans and your bettors, because without them, we're just match racing.
You have to have a process in place that's not, well, the one vet says this and the other vet says this. Right. So hold on, let me call the mutuals department and see what they did. And then, wait, did you scratch the horse? No, put the horse back in. Oh, wait, no, now these horses running, take them back. Like, guys, there has to be a better process in place in a race where there's tens of millions of dollars of gambling money on the line. It's just, you know, for a sport that is the bedrock of the game is betting, to treat the bettors like they don't matter over and over again. And then you wonder why people walk away. I can't blame them after what happened on Friday. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy Bloodstock will be strongly represented at the Keeneland November sale this week. They have weanlings by First Crop Sires Catalina Cruiser, Vino Rosso, and Matoli, and have mares in foal to hot young sires like Omaha Beach and Authentic, Tis the Law, and more. They'll kick off the sale at Barn 24, so be sure to stop by if you're on the sales grounds. Check out the Legacy consignment. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's monumental edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. Keeneland November is going on right now and runs through next Friday, November 19th. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guests of the week, Travis Tiger and Tessa Muir, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week.